In the Old Testament, in the book of Psalms, in the Psalter, the third psalm this evening. Psalm number 3, a psalm of David when he fled from his son Absalom, that is, in his old age. O Lord, how many are my foes? This is after David had conquered all the nations around him. He was master then of the Middle East. How many rise against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. But you are a shield around me, O Lord, my glorious one who lifts high my head. To the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill. And at that time, it may have been that aged David was hiding in the Judean hills in flight from his son. I lie down to sleep, maybe in the open air. I wake again because the Lord sustains me. I will not fear the tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. Arise, O Lord, deliver me, O my God. For you have struck all my enemies on the jaw. You have broken the teeth of the wicked. From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your, emphasis on the your. Not David's people, although he's king of Israel. But may your blessing be on your people. Amen. May God bless to us his holy word. The third psalm is the first of 14 whose superscriptions refer to historical episodes in David's life. The others, if you wanted to know, and we'll come to them, or some of them in due course, our psalm number 7, 18, 30, 34, 51, of course, 54, 56, 57, 59, 60, 63, and 142. This one, so early in the Psalter, has to do with David's later life, as we have said at the reading. When the latter of the two major crises of David's life took place, it followed his sin with Bathsheba, which, due to divine chastening, led, I believe, and this is an interpretation, whose sin with Bathsheba, due to divine chastening, led, I believe, to the revolt of his son Absalom. And it was that that drove the aged David out of his capital in pathetic flight from his arrogant son. The earlier crisis took place in David's youth, after he was anointed king in place of Saul, but before he began to reign, since, of course, he was still a fugitive from the deranged Saul. It was then that David, pushed to the limit temporarily by a lapse of faith, gave up hope and ran away of all things to the Philistines to shelter with them, if you please, for something like 16 months. 1 Samuel 27 and 7. Now, for David to do that and to say why he was doing it, that he would perish one day at the hand of Saul, was an awful declaration of unfaith. Of unfaith for any child of God, especially one designated and anointed king of God's people. I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul, he said. There is nothing better for me. The language is shocking. There is nothing better for me to do than to escape into the land of the Philistines. Which he did. And it was then, long 16 months with the Philistines, it was then apparently that David met Maaka, the daughter of Talmai, the Bedouin chieftain. And David made this woman another of his wives. And it was she who bore him this handsome Adonis, the troublemaker of his later days, Absalom. And he loved him with an intense carnal love, which was the undoing of them both, in a sense. But you remember that David repented of his defection to the Philistines and returned to the fold and called on the name of the Lord, 1 Samuel 36 and 7. And for the rest of David's life, until his many conquests of the surrounding nations took place, the Lord prospered David exceedingly. But then, as is a very great danger with prosperity, even the Lord's prosperity, then he grew complacent and no longer went out to battle with his army, but stayed at home. And you remember, let his eyes rove towards another man's beautiful wife, Bathsheba, whom he took and defiled. And God was angry and sent Nathan the prophet to charge David with this heinous sin, which not only involved adultery, but eventually murder. Thou art the man. But you see, repentance was one thing. The consequences of the sin, even forgiven. Oh, notice that. The consequences, the natural consequences of the sin, even though forgiven, was another matter. We here learned that years ago from Miss Webster Smith, that great warrior missionary to Japan, when she came within a day or two of her death, actually. She died on the way to a meeting in Edinburgh, a day or two after she spent a weekend with us here. And she told us of visiting Japanese war criminals in jail and bringing some of them to Christ. But according to the justice of the Allies under General MacArthur, these Japanese generals still had to pay the penalty of their execrable deeds in execution. David, by his sin with this poor woman, had set in motion something which I believe lay dormant all the time of David's prosperity. But as soon as David sinned grievously in his old age, in presuming that such a great man as he was above God's moral law, he abrogated God's protection from evil. And so he exposed himself to the wiles of Satan, who, of course, gladly activated the potential of his earlier defection. And that unfortunate marriage, or concubinage, rather, as I would say. And that afforded Satan the opportunity to stir ambition in Absalom's heart, to depose his father, and to stir it all the more because David had disciplined his favorite son by banishment, you remember, for seducing his half-sister Tamar. Hence David's undignified flight from the heartless cruelty of his son. Ah, you see, to indulge a wayward child and then try to deal faithfully with him when he has gone too far certainly will lead to ructions of unprincipled anger and vindictive fury. Principles of grace inevitably incorporate rule of law. You may call it the iron hand in the velvet glove, but it is an iron which the long psalmist delights in, the iron of the law, because he sees it as part of grace and sees its integration with gracious ways as an essential part of good, of the good and true and happy life. There cannot be true happiness without law and recognition of law in life. And there is no doubt that David's love for young Absalom was exceedingly carnal, as doubtless was his love for his mother Maaka. And where sheer carnality, notice this, where sheer carnality, even in legitimate family relationships, prevails, everything goes wrong. And everything certainly went wrong here. Well, listen to poor David and picture the old man as he climbs the hill of the Mount of Olives, weeping as he hurried from his dear Jerusalem, crying as the psalm does, O Lord, how many are my foes? How many rise up against me? Many are saying of me, God will not deliver him. And of course, these two verses form the first short movement of this brief symphony, or if you like, first short scene of the play. But who would have thought that a man such as David, the most illustrious monarch of his day and one of the most gifted and versatile men of any age, would reach the zenith of Israel's power? Well, read of his conquests in the first part of 2 Samuel. Conquests which ensured the peace and the glory of Solomon's benign reign after David. Solomon's benign reign to match Solomon's name, Shalom, Solomon. Who would have thought that such a man as David, this illustrious monarch, this great conqueror, this master conqueror, should come to this and be a fugitive from his own son over the hills, from that Bedouin upstart of a son who was indeed far down the line of David's legitimate successors. He hadn't a hope, legally speaking. You see, the reverses of fortune of some of the towering giants of history is one of the most humbling things to contemplate. The Nebuchadnezzars, the man crawling on the ground like a beast, the great world conqueror of Babylon and his empire, the Alexanders, the Caesars, the Neros, Hannibals, who committed suicide rather than surrender, the Kaisers, the Stalins, the Hitlers, the Nkrumahs, the Amins, Mazitungs. What ends these men came to? Think of David's own lament over King Saul. How are the mighty fallen and the weapons of war perished? But practically all these overlords were enemies of the God of Israel and of Israel's son, Messiah. But it is not so with David. He is the Lord's anointed. Indeed, he is one of the most illustrious Old Testament types of Christ. And so we may ask, does the Lord allow his anointed to suffer so, even for his sins? Yes, yes. Even without sin, as we know from our blessed Lord's sinless suffering. That's the meaning of the cross on its under sinister side. The pure malevolence of men against our Lord's perfect humanity is seen so clearly. When all that our blessed Lord wanted to do, he wanted to do absolutely nothing else on his mortal life's way than do good to others. And yet, see how he suffered, which is an essential part of the adversary's imposition on fallen men. Do-gooders, beware. The devil is out to get you. And if inspired by God, you attain to acts and deeds of mercy and charity, and then fall into significant sin, as David did in his old age, the dastardly devil will make a field day of his attack on you, and delight to hold you up to the ridicule of the whole world, if he can. Israel's name in the later centuries of the Old Testament was more than mud to the surrounding nations. A name that had been so glorious and illustrious in David's own day and Solomon's day. That's what the devil loves to do. If he can bring a Christian down, it's far more to him than some other pagan in the gutter. He loves it. And this is one of the things, you see, which can plague weaklings. And are we not all that when it comes to the point? Which can plague weaklings laid hold on by God to serve him despite their inherent frailties. How many times through life I have said to the Lord, why pick on me? When I've looked round to see others far more suitable and gifted than I, why pick on me? What if in the midst of serving the Lord, this is the fear, or one of the fears, what if in the midst of serving the Lord, the devil should trip me up and expose me, not only to the Christian public, but to the eyes of the whole world as a singular and significant sinner? It's a terrible thought. It would terrify anyone, which can paralyze all effort to do good, lest the enemy suddenly break in like a flood and sweep us off our feet, and we are undone before we know what has happened to us. Ah, but God has a word for that, which he gave through the blessed apostle. We quoted it this morning. He has a word for that to comfort and assure his weak children. Listen, no temptation has seized you except what is common to man. And God is faithful. That is to say, you can trust him, as you can trust no other, of course. He will not let you be tempted beyond what you can bear. But when you are tempted, he will also provide a way out, an exodus. That's exactly what the word exodus, hexodus, the way out. He will also provide a way out so that you can stand up, says the NIV, so that you can stand up under it. That's the word the Lord gives to those who fear and dread that they may fail and be held up to public disgrace, to comfort and assure his weak children that they are not at the mercy of the foe. Of course, this is a word to the faithful who, being aware of the danger, shelter most definitely under the canopy of God's loving protection. And we know that there can be no safety otherwise. How could there be? Do you suppose that if we deliberately and wantonly run out from under the shelter of the Lord by choosing evil, as David did with Bathsheba, so deliberately, that this great word of assurance that I've just read would still apply? Surely not. That would be monstrous license on the part of the holy God, and utterly at odds with his righteous nature. No. As we were saying last Sunday, there is no refuge from the Lord in the Lord's grief and sorrow at our backsliding and our inevitable exposure to evil. There is no refuge from the Lord but to return and run into him again. He is the only refuge. There is none other. And that's exactly what David did, as the third verse of our psalm shows. You are a shield around me, O Lord, my glorious one who lifts high my head. this is what he shouted to the Lord. You are my shield. And with that cry of assurance, you see, David's faith rose until he went on to declare his confidence in his glorious one who lifts high his head. Now notice there how he acknowledges what his God is to him before he makes any request of him. And that's important. A little child keeps running to its mother for this and for that and for the other, and never thinks to say thank you for what mother has already given and done. But it should not be so with mature servants of God and soldiers of the cross. Acknowledgement with thanksgiving and praise first. Not to say adoration, if you can come to anything so pure and worship as that. Then, don't rush into the Lord's presence, except in the extremest emergency. Don't rush into the Lord's presence with all your requests and your shopping list. That's what we learned in prayer years ago. Worship him first. The prayers of the Bible are full of this. Nehemiah, Ezra. Worship him first. Acknowledge with thanksgiving and praise his goodness and his greatness. Then cry for help. The Lord will be much more disposed to help, and that right early. If even in our throes we are seen to be grateful and not forever confronting him with our begging bowl. And there's a lesson for us here in the love of the young, in their courtships. The essential feature of young love is that it is so taken up with delight in its beloved that it asks no more than simply to be together. And that's the essence of love. Although other things follow from it, of course. So David cries aloud. He cries loud to God. And what do you think? An answer comes. Where from? From God's holy hill. Ah, David may have been bivouacking on some bare hillside out in the open, or in some kind of makeshift tent or wigwam. But the Lord was still in his holy temple in Jerusalem. Absalom may drive his own father out of his palace, but he cannot drive the Lord out of his holy hill as long as he is determined to remain there in the interests of fugitive David. There's always help from God's holy hill to the humble, needy, and it came to David. But in what sort of way did it come to David? Well, the next verse tells us, "You are a shield around me, O Lord, my glorious one, who lifts high my head. To the Lord I cry aloud, and he answers me from his holy hill." But how does he answer me? In sweet and sound sleep, despite the fact that Absalom with his supporters might have been out on the hillside searching for his father to do him in. Oh yes. And of course that reminded me instantly of the shepherd's psalm. "Yea, though I walk through the valley of the shadow of death, I will fear no evil, for you are with me as rod and staff to support and protect me. Indeed, you prepare a table for me in the wilderness, in the presence of mine enemies. Let Absalom do what he likes. Why, it occurred to me that the shepherd psalm may have been written by David upon this very experience. I hadn't thought of that before, had you? So, take the two psalms together, 3 and 23. For you see, their kinship is close. And in the 23rd, you have David feasting in the midst of that inhospitable desert. And you, if you've been to the wilderness of Judea, you will know how inhospitable it is. And then lying down to sweet sleep, probably under the stars, the dear old man. And then to wake in the morning and realize that the Lord had watched over him and sustained him in blessed rest to face the next day of his fugitive journey, probably towards some kind of safety across Jordan. And if you want to revel in all this, read this exciting story in 2 Samuel chapters 15 to 18. That will be a lovely, lovely bedtime story and a nightcap tonight. And so he rises in the morning like a giant refreshed, and with such sure trust in the Lord, who has given him such peace in the midst of a harrowing situation, such an awful situation for an illustrious old king, that he shouts his defiance of his wicked son and the malign conspiracy engineered against him. I will not fear tens of thousands drawn up against me on every side. No, because for all David's backsliding, and he knows he is suffering for the sins of his old age, he has committed himself to the Lord's care. He is still the Lord's servant, even if, as I fear from his subsequent history is the case, he is no longer the Lord's soldier. I do not believe that after Bathsheba, David was any longer a soldier of the Lord. He was, in effect, disqualified. You see, we must take Paul's words seriously when he speaks about running the Lord's race. He says, I do not run aimlessly, nor do I box or fight as beating the air. Rather, he says, as someone has translated it rather grimly, rather I beat my body black and blue to make it my slave. Not Satan's slave, but my slave. So that after I have preached to others, I myself will not be disqualified. 1 Corinthians 9:26-27. And disqualified, as I'm suggesting, David may have been from then onwards. I certainly believe that he was. Read his history to its sad end. Disqualified from the quality of creative work which had established the glorious kingdom that his son Solomon inherited. But David was still the Lord's man. And as with Elijah in his later days, after Elisha appeared on the scene, the Lord was kind to him personally. To the end. So, having woken from sleep himself And for all his age and the awful ordeal and trauma he went through yesterday, he's up with the lark or the corresponding bird in Israel to look up to heaven and say, "Are you awake, Lord? Surely you are. You slumber not nor sleep." Well then, today's another day, Lord, and you have me to look after, remember? Ah, Lord, but I shouldn't be so hasty with you. You are never late. Why, already, I feel it in my bones. You have given that erring son of mine, whom I have loved not wisely but too well, you have given that erring son of mine such a clout on the jaw, verse 7, as will make him more than real. And the Lord had, indeed, as we know from the history, talk about breaking his teeth, as you also read in this 7th verse. Talk about breaking his teeth, as the psalmist does here. The history says more than Absalom's teeth were broken. His neck was broken as he hung, you remember, between earth and heaven in that tree, until David's rash nephew, Joab, Absalom's cousin, came on the scene and finished the poor fellow off as he hung between earth and heaven, fixed by his neck and the branches of the tree. But you may think such ruthless sentiments do not accord with the history, especially the warning given by David to his royal guard when he sent them out after his son. Don't harm that boy if and when you find him. Nor David's exceeding great lament when he learned that his son was dead. Listen to this. When David eventually learned that Absalom was dead, the king was shaken. He went up to the room over the gateway and wept. As he went, he said, "Oh, my son Absalom, my son Absalom, listen. If only I had died instead of you, oh, Absalom. My son, I'm not forgetting all that, having gone over the story too often to misread it. That, of course, was after the boy was dead and David himself was safe, but at the moment, as a fugitive, the king is marooned and beleaguered in the middle of a waste wilderness, if ever there was one. And his thoughts, beyond his own safety, were for the apprehension of that son of his, and for his due punishment. Not to say restraining him from going after his old father to slay him. And yet I said the king's thoughts were for his own safety, and therefore for the apprehension of this unruly son of his, to restrain him from the knavish trick of driving his father from his throne. But before I pursue that, it just occurred to me as I was typing this, is there anything in the whole record of Absalom's life to betray the slightest sign of faith in God or mention of God's name? Not a hint. He was as pagan as Esau. He was apparently the complete pagan. And he, if you please, aspired to that throne which anyone with any common knowledge or sense knew was Jehovah's throne, with David the appointed and anointed occupant of it. And for this young infidel to have grown up under the aegis of godly David as the king's favorite son, and yet had a ghost of an idea what Jehovah's kingdom was or meant, seems to me to be almost beyond belief. Could he have been so deaf and blind to everything godly, this boy? Was he so indulged by his father that such things were never spoken of together? And yet, if David in his carnal love for Absalom pocketed his religion every time he spoke with Absalom and put it on ice, so that all their talk was of earthly things, if that's really the case, and it looks like it, David asked for all he got from this young man, didn't he? His love for him was fleshly, as his love for his mother. How could the young fellow have lived in Jerusalem practically all his life and have known his father as such a spiritual, godly man? Read David's Psalms to see that, for all his faults. And yet nothing of that rubbed off on the boy. There's something terribly wrong here, isn't there? So wrong that we needn't inquire any more concerning it, because we might very well come to wrong conclusions and do injustice to the memory of a great and godly man, one of the greatest who ever lived, David. All I'm saying is that this cocky aspirant to his father's throne was surely the least fit of all David's numerous progeny to occupy the throne. Certainly a far cry from Solomon, for all Solomon's later faults. But I was thinking of David's preoccupation with his own safety and with the arrest, the apprehension of his wayward son. And you see, the last verse of this significant psalm tells us something different from David's preoccupation with himself. From the Lord comes deliverance. May your blessing be on your people. There comes a time in life, after all, when sanity, prudence, and a measure of heavenly, godly, biblical wisdom have taken root within us, when we are no longer concerned about ourselves and our welfare. It stands to reason that if our lives have been taken up with the building of something far beyond our personal concerns, however personally concerned we are with ourselves and our welfare, I mean, if our life has been taken up with the welfare of Christ's church, that in time becomes a far greater concern to us than our personal welfare, since our days are numbered anyway, then is that surprising? At any rate, I certainly believe that one of the most meaningful words in our psalm is in this last verse, this last line. David's concern for his people, the Lord's people. We were looking at that at Psalm 83 last evening. The psalmist was concerned about the people more than himself, because they were the Lord's people, not his people. But they were the Lord's people. And David is saying about his subjects as king, your blessing on your people. You can see this to some extent in our beloved Queen. I believe the dear woman is far more concerned about her people than about herself as a person, although I could imagine she says many, many prayers for her children and their marriages and where the next generation is going to go. For instance, has the Duchess of York been in church yet since her child was born? She wasn't at Crathy, and she was 2 Sundays there. And her first public engagement was presenting prizes at some sporting event last Sunday afternoon. Ah, dear Elizabeth, you'll need to pray hard for these youngsters. But you see, many years as head of the Commonwealth has given our Queen a great concern for her peoples, those of them remaining. And that was David's concern. It didn't matter so much to him whether he remained king himself or not, I believe, as long as the succession, in the interest of God's will and of the people, was right. Mind you, there came a day when David was past thinking about that. You remember? When he was dying? Poor Bathsheba remembered that David had said that her son, her second son to David, to David, Solomon, the first one, you remember, had to die a judicial death because of David's sin. But David had said that her second son, Solomon, had been designated by him to succeed him. And you remember it was cunning Adonijah who thought he was further up the line, and was indeed. Adonijah was determined that he would snatch the throne, so that it was almost at the last moment that the throne was secured for Solomon, the king of peace, to succeed David, the king of war. But you see, I like David's word here. He says to the Lord, may your blessing be on your people. I suppose this is what made David the shepherd boy so great a man, his complete deferring to a greater than himself, even his God. His people as king were God's people. He sought nothing for himself. And that reminds me of Jeremiah's pungent and pertinent comment to his secretary Baruch at a time, you remember, when the kingdom of Judah was collapsing all around them. And the secretary Baruch was naturally wondering what was to become of him and his master. And the Lord said to Baruch through the prophet Jeremiah, this is what I say to you. I will overthrow what I have built. This is startling, isn't it? I'll pull down what I built up. I will overthrow what I have built, and I will uproot what I have planted throughout the land. God's saying that. Should you then seek great things for yourself? Seek them not, for I will bring disaster on all people. declares the Lord. But God's kindness for the man, like God's kindness for David, although I believe he was disqualified and no longer a soldier. But he says, wherever you go, I will let you escape with your life. That was a wonderful concession, wasn't it, to the ambitious secretary? I will let you escape with your life. You see, God is God, and we at the very best are his servants. And he who cares for his servants will look after our welfare, and will do so with the greatest consideration and care and tenderness when we are most concerned for him and for his people. So the end of the story, if we like a happy ending. David got back to his palace, the old man. And God cared for him in an evil day, just as he did Jeremiah's secretary. And when we apply that to ourselves in our day, we need to say to ourselves, our concern is to be for his glory and for his cause, and he will look after us. Well, you know, he is well able to look after us. He has a good deal of experience of caring for people, hasn't he? Our God, our shepherd God. We should trust him.